Hickety-spickety somber kazing. I want your attention to everything. We're packing to leave. Come on, let's go. No, no, not you. Books are always first, you know.
Nobody does magic quite like Disney. The science-y wizard, the wand, the spells, it's all burned into our collective consciousness. Along with the idea that it's all silly nonsense. But hey, what about this?
So I should back up a second here and say I'm talking in a way that a year ago I would never have talked. I wouldn't have used the words magic, and I wouldn't have talked about spirits or anything of that sort.
That's Dr. Dean Radin, the Dr. Dean Radin, preeminent parapsychology researcher, pioneering researcher, and he's talking with today's guest, author and chaos magician, Gordon White.
And this is all relatively new for me. I know a little bit more than I did a year ago because I just wrote a book on this. But the thing that sparked my interest in looking into the esoteric traditions is that I've been working in cybersearch for something like 3 decades, almost 4 decades now. And I had to think really hard for anybody who ever talked about what a couple of anthropologists will talk about the psychic and shaman connections as real, as opposed to as theater. And the most recent large book, which is the state-of-the-art book on the cybersearch called Handbook of Parapsychology for the 21st Century, the word magic doesn't even show up in the index. I found this kind of puzzling because I'm, of course, everybody's well aware of what the shamans claim to be able to do, and we're well aware that of notions of what magic is, at least the way it's portrayed in entertainment. And I became curious as to why it doesn't show up. I mean, I'm involved in the profession of studying magic, if we think of magic in the proper terms. So I went through this whole business of seeing if I can synthesize what are the basic magical practices and seeing if I can map it onto cybersearch. And of course, it completely maps.
It's 100% maps.
It's 100% match. And so then I was shocked that, well, how come I didn't know this? No, it's partially because no one ever talks about it. Why is that? Well, we're being scientists. That's why.
So fully take that in for a minute. The leading light of psi research, Dean Radin, is telling us that psi, the stuff that's blown the lid off of grandpa's dopey old materialistic science, well, he seems to be saying that isn't really science at all. It's maybe better termed magic.
Yeah, I have this definition down to a refined sentence now that I then subsequently explain, which is magic is a culture-specific way of using or interacting with the natural consciousness capacities of a particular human.
Here's Gordon again. This time he's chatting it up with Philip Watt on his magic-themed podcast, Redesigning Society. But tell me, as you're listening, does this sound like a podcast about magic or a science podcast? Because I'm not sure which is which anymore.
So that might sound a bit circular, but actually, if you look across the world at systems or cultures that have never repudiated magic in the same way that the Northwest European Enlightenment did, and I'd be very specific about that in Europe, because you actually find in Southern Europe that it's carried on merrily in the kind of folk traditions of Italian grandmothers and so on. But it's that very specific Cartesian post-Enlightenment world out of all of human history that repudiated it. But if you look around the world, there are sort of what you might call quote-unquote magical powers, for want of a less dramatic term, a number of techniques that are reasonably conserved. So you have some method of seeing the future or clairvoyance. You have some method of communicating across distance. So you have telepathy or whatever you want to call it. These are just modern words for capacities, right? And then you have interacting with or communicating with the spirit world. And then you have some method as a result of that, typically of what I would call probability enhancement or probability manipulation, which is to make the things that you want happen more often than the things that you don't want to happen. What's interesting to me about that is if you look at the history of, say, the development of PSY and the Society for Psychical Research and all these kind of groups that emerged about 150 years ago, we now have 150 years of evidence from mostly laboratory evidence that basically falls neatly into these four categories.
Now, don't get me wrong. It's not like I'm pining for a simple-minded world of biological robots in a meaningless universe, a paradigm that we've thoroughly trashed on this show over the years. But at the same time, I'm not entirely sure Dean Radin knows what he's signing up for. Here's occult philosophy expert, and more importantly, practicing ceremonial magician, Dr. Stephen Skinner, on Greg Carlwood's Higher Side Chats show.
One of the basic grimoire things is that the parchment that you do the key seals on things must be made from an animal, because parchment is animal skin, and that you should make it yourself. And I have done that, and it's quite an interesting procedure, and it's hard work. And I can tell you that parchment, rather than paper or plastic or something, is much more effective. So perhaps in some reason, the spirit can, I won't say see it, but understand the sigils on it, because it's written on something that was once living. As you just sketch it out with a compass on a piece of paper, it's much, much, much less effective.
Wow.
People will not push themselves to do those things. One day, somebody may discover how you can do sigils on plastic and still get the same effect, but it sure as hell is not going to be me.
Yeah, I mean, once we can do it on Facebook, we're all going to be set.
Yeah, it won't happen. It will not happen.
Yeah.
There are only certain images and things that the spirits recognize, and these are not what comes up on Facebook.
Damn. Well, as for people's fears on this kind of stuff, I've heard you discuss the classic notion of the Faustian pact, this idea of making a deal with a trickster and losing your soul, and that it was more of a Christian invention to scare people off. And I think that's really interesting. How can we separate real concerns and dangers in dealing with this kind of thing from that lingering propaganda residue?
Okay. You're absolutely right. It was largely a Christian gloss on the Faust books that he lost his soul. The pact is real, but the pact is what the spirit makes with you, and it's his obligations to you that are written into the pact. The whole idea of you lose your soul or whatever at the end, I think, is a priest's view rather than a magician's view. There are dangers in magic. One of them is obsession. There are a number of people who get obsessed or possessed anyway. But if you're actually actively calling a particular spirit and you have no defense and you don't know what you're doing, then it is occasionally happens that the spirit will take up residence. And then you've got a serious problem and you need an exorcist who knows what they're doing. So there are dangers in doing magic. It's like, you know, electricity. With the right insulation at the right circle, the right phylactery, you don't get zapped. But if you do these things and, you know, handle the wire without the right precautions, then you may get zapped. So some magic like physics or doing household electrics is not without danger.
Brave be the scientist who wants to bring that into the lab. But that may in fact be the future of parapsychology. And it's one of the reasons I wanted to talk to Gordon today on Skeptico. How do you really bring magic into the lab? If you come to that worldview shift and you say, okay, I really don't understand what I'm measuring. He wants his scientific cake and he wants to eat it too. I mean, isn't there an inherent problem with that?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think you sort of nailed it when you said, you mentioned 20 years in terms of people kind of looking at Dr. Radin's research and sort of figuring out what he was doing or is doing. I think in a lot of fields, we're at that point now where To sort of quote Pete Carroll, magic works in practice, but not in theory. So I'm sort of sanguine about it. Dean's going to be wrong, as we all are. And I think between now and how we get to, even the word science is maybe not correct for it, but how we get to a method of inquiry that is a least worst match for these phenomena, it's going to require a lot of things. It's going to require interdisciplinary research. So it's going to require anthropology. It's going to require history, biology. It's going to need all these things. And we don't have the words for it because our conception of the world has sort of outrun the way we structure learning about things, even adding ology to a word and putting it in little sort of pillars and categories.
All that and much, much more on this episode of Skeptico. Today we welcome Gordon White back to Skeptico. Gordon is the creator of Rune Soup, where he talks and writes about magic, culture, the paranormal, among other things. You may remember Gordon's appearance on Skeptico to talk about his excellent book, Starships, which is one of several books he's authored that you can find on his website or just by searching his name on Amazon like we all do. He also was on for a very excellent interview that I know a lot of people saw, but if you didn't, I think you'd really want to check it out. It's with plasma physicist Dr. John Brandenburg. And he's here today to really talk about the future of parapsychology, but we may get into talking about the future of UFO research as well. I have some really interesting stuff lined up for Gordon. We'll see how all this goes. Welcome back, Gordon. Thanks for joining me.
Always a pleasure to be here.
So I tell you what, without a lot of introduction, I want to just jump right in the middle of this, and I think people will catch on very quickly in terms of where I'm going. A couple of months ago, you published a couple of almost back-to-back interviews that were terrific and had an amazing overlap with a lot of the stuff we do here on Skeptico. One was with probably the most prominent and well-known parapsychology researcher of our time, Dr. Dean Radin, who comes on Rune Soup and announces that parapsychology is out and magic is probably at the core of what he's really been studying for the last 30 years. So that kind of sets you rocking. And then you have an interview with parapsychologist and tricksterologist George Hansen, who pretty much in the course of an hour took back all the best and most interesting things ever said about the trickster phenomenon, at least in my opinion he did. So again, with parapsychology being kind of one of the pillars of this show, I thought, wow, you know, why are these people saying this stuff to this magic guy who has been kind of become, you know, quickly one of this kind of go-to crossover magic, parapsychology, paranormal, geopolitics thing that you do. And voila, here you are on Skype, on Skeptico. So that's, I think, our launching off point.
Yeah, sounds good.
So let's start with that. I set it up. What did you think? Dean Radin comes on the show and says, hey, Gordon, we're brothers here. It's all about magic. I mean, what did you make of that? And what does that mean for parapsychology? I guess it's really cutting right to the chase.
Well, like yourself, I've been a fan of Dr. Radin for a very long time. I love his stuff. So, and one of the things I really resonate with, and one of the things that I think is great about his work, is that he dances or marches to his own drum. So
I think he's correct, obviously, when he said that it was sort of a, well, welcome to the tent, Dr. Radin. And I think we've kind of had that discussion in between a couple of years ago when Starships came out, and we had that discussion where I said, I think magic works better as the kind of meta model for understanding all the things we talk about. And I think it really does work better as a descriptor and baseline model. And one of the challenges with parapsychology, and it's something Dr. Radin and I spoke about, is that it still has, just by virtue of historical inertia, a lot of kind of like 19th century premises, which they know are not correct, but even just the word parapsychology is constructed in a way that limits where the model or the sort of field can go next. And so I think Dr. Radin should be congratulated to go, do you know what? Mankind, which is obviously singing my song, mankind has been doing this for a long time. This is what it is. And all these other words we use for it are, quote unquote, just words.
But it gets tricky, right? You know, I sent you another interview he did after he did your show. He did Rick Archer's Bat Gap, which was kind of a really interesting interview, too, because it ventured into the spiritual without really getting into the spiritual. But a couple of things that he revealed, he said, look, until about 4 or 5 years ago, I wasn't really ready to give up materialism completely. And I thought, wow, you know, that really surprised me. I got the sense that he had kind of jumped onto that boat and left the shore a while back. And I couldn't help but feel, even though, like you, I have the utmost respect for his work and for his accomplishments. What he's done in the field is truly remarkable and needs to be held up and really appreciated in a way that it won't be for another 20 years, but then that's the way it always is. But I'm not sure he's really left all that sciencey stuff before. How do you really bring magic into the lab? If you come to that worldview shift and you say, okay, I really don't understand what I'm measuring. I'm giving up my presumption that I'm really going to be able to measure it. Then, you know, he wants his scientific cake and he wants to eat it too. I mean, isn't there an inherent problem with that?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think you sort of nailed it when you said, you mentioned 20 years in terms of people kind of looking at Dr. Radin's research and sort of figuring out what he was doing or is doing. I think in a lot of fields, we're at that point now where, to sort of quote Pete Carroll, magic works in practice, but not in theory. So I'm sort of sanguine about it. Dean's going to be wrong. As we all are. And I think between now and how we get to, even the word science is maybe not correct for it, but how we get to a method of inquiry that is a least worst match for these phenomena, it's going to require a lot of things. It's going to require interdisciplinary research. So it's going to require anthropology. It's going to require history, biology. It's going to need all these things. And we don't have the words for it because our conception of the world has sort of outrun the way we structure learning about things, even adding ology to a word and putting it in little sort of pillars and categories.
I'll tell you what, let's take that to its natural conclusion. Tell me what happens when Dean brings magic into the lab. Like, which we, let's not talk totally inside baseball. I don't mind talking inside baseball on this show. It's kind of the nature of it. But, you know, Dean is probably most famous for his Six Sigma result that he's gotten from presentiment work, right? So the computer displays an image on the screen and they measure my physiological response to it, pupils dilating, skin emitting, whatever. They're going to measure that and I'm going to, and that's going to be, that reaction is going to happen before the image is actually selected by the computer. You've heard all that a million, everyone's heard all that a million times. And the result of that, he gets these off the wall, statistically significant results. So let's not talk about specifically bringing that into the lab. Oh, I'm sorry, I digressed too far there. But so one of the things he's also known for is taking that experiment, which was done over and over again, replicated like something like 50 times or something, primarily with college students, just people off the street who don't have any professed special powers. But he did some that maybe point to this future that we're going to talk about of what happens when you bring a magician in the lab. And that is, he brought quote unquote accomplished meditators and said, okay, you seem to have this ability to transcend time and space. At least that's what you report in your meditation. Let's see how you perform in this. Do you perform any better at this now that we've shown that? Which is a wonderful thing, you know, to get to level two, where we no longer just have to bang on the same thing. Yes, it happened. Yes, it happened. Yes, it happened. Now he says, hey, does it happen differently when I bring in these people? And the result is, yes, it does happen differently to people who say they have the ability to transcend space and time. And oops, here it shows up in the lab. Do you see something like that happening when the magician enters the lab?
Yeah, I do. And I think the change for parapsychology is going to be, for the last 150 years, and rightly so, they've been extremely rigorous and almost nitpicky with experimental protocols and the results they have, because they've been, you know, climbing a wall of derision for 150 years. So the game in that first 1.5 centuries has been to say, like, here are the actual numbers. Here is the spreadsheet. Riddle me this, materialists. Now, the trouble is, the next model, and I think Dean's right, and it's heading in the right direction to bring meditators in. When you're dealing with magic, or a magic either as a practice or magic as a improved way of thinking about the world so that we may learn new things, you kind of get a non-specific uplift in people's lives. So that's why you get similar, I contend, that's why you get similar results in terms of, you know, healing and synchronicity from people who are doing full-blown magic versus people who are regularly praying in temple or church or what have you. So you kind of have to jump it up and make peace with the fact that the results aren't going to be as nitpicky as parapsychology is typically used to. And it is in that kind of weird, you can get the trajectories rather than pin down the numbers. And I don't know how long it's going to take for potentially the field to have the confidence to stand behind that as results in the same way that they do, you know, the really, really precise stuff, because that's kind of, you know, generals fighting the last war.
Or, you know, very clever researchers like Radin, who've been around the block and have the battle scars from all those wars, are going to be very creative, like he has been, and think of ways to kind of work around the anticipated, you know, pushback and do it from the beginning. Because I don't think there's any other way to get around that science-y part. You're going to have to produce results, and you're going to have to produce off the charts results to get anyone's attention. Otherwise, everyone's going to just, you know, look the other way or worse, you know.
I think, and Dr. Radin and I kind of spoke about that when he came on the show, rather his biggest impact isn't going to be when he gets magicians into the lab, because arguably, as we know, that's been done before in various MK projects in the 20th century. But his biggest impact is going to be in that just classic Dean way, when he stands up at these parapsychological events around the world and just says, magic, magic, magic. I study magic. We all study magic. Thank you for your time. That is going to, you know, cause a few monocles to drop out of people's eyes initially. But the more he makes it okay to use the M word, the kind of bigger uplift in or the kind of new directions the research can go. And so in that sense, he's absolutely the right person to do it, because he does not care very much what other people think, which is to be admired.
And where do you think that new direction gets us? I love what he's doing and what he's saying. On the other hand, and this has parallels with the Hansen interview that we'll talk about in a minute, it does get rather fuzzy the more he gets into it. And he starts saying, you know, well, this is kind of, it's really all about parapsychology that I've been studying anyway. And I'm kind of like, no, I think it is something more. There is something essentially different about magic that if you leave that behind, then you will just be repeating parapsychology experiments and we won't really be advancing. Do you kind of get where I'm driving
at with that? Yeah, 100%, because I would argue, and I did argue it, and we've had this discussion, that they are doing magic. Like if you're doing telepathy research, congratulations, you're doing magic in the lab. Like as far as I'm concerned, that's the case. So yes, there is the risk in the hands of, you know, lesser researchers that you can just say, okay, well, we'll call it magic now and we'll do another telepathy experiment. You go, well, no. I think... And funny, like Dean kind of mentioned this, where he says, you know, parapsychologists have physics envy. You reach the end of the usefulness of the discourse as a standalone. And this is what I mean about the next steps need to be interdisciplinary. And particularly, I think, with anthropology, because we now have the opportunity to engage with kind of non-Western modes of doing this stuff and thinking about it on a level footing almost, because we kind of turned around and gone, well, turns out you guys were correct. And I think, I don't know what it will look like, but I know if parapsychology doesn't want to fall into a repetition trap just using the M word, it needs some sort of interdisciplinary experience. And the challenge there is that nobody likes it. Everyone thinks they're crackpots. Anthropologists, I think quietly, as in non-publicly, will be amenable to it. And so they're probably the first ones you want to go looking for rather than wandering up to physicists or neuroscientists. And I think they've kind of been chasing after the wrong friends in the playground for a while. And jokes on the people who ignored them, because you get these two together and start building other ones. And it's that's where the interesting stuff's going to happen in the next few decades, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of think that cuts both ways. I mean, when you started that, you said, you know, if you're studying telepathy in the parapsychology lab, congratulations, you're studying magic. And I'd almost say, no, you have to, you can't go there. That is, to me, conceding to the fact that I don't know what the hell I'm studying. You know, I'm open to the idea that I'm studying more than telepathy. But I don't know the beginnings of where that turns into magic, where that has connections with anthropology, where that has connections with the spirit world, which again, Dean, you know, you push him on that. He's backing off way, way, way off fast as he can and is kind of trying to find the safe space super sci thing, which is just, again, you know, the last refuge of the holding on of the material thing. I don't think you are there in the magical world. And, you know, I jotted down a note and I sent it to you too. I was going to mention, you know, a guy that you liked and you've pointed to in your work, Dr. Stephen Skinner, you know, who go listen to him. And I do not. I just, wow, we could have a lengthy discussion on him. But here's a guy. Bring him into the lab and he'll say, oh, you know, it's important how sharp the knife is as you drag it around the floor, the stone floor, you know, and he's saying all this bizarre stuff that I suspect if you got him in the lab, because I've interviewed so many of these types of people who they're all 95%, you know, they're all, I'm 90, what I do, I'm 95% effective. It almost always works. And then he's drawn all these conclusions and it works because the sword is so sharp and the pentagram is drawn just perfectly and all the rest of this stuff. And I'm like, man, that stuff is going to fall apart when you bring it into the lab. And whether it's in the lab or whether you go study him in his room, I don't care what you do. They just don't have, in my experience, they don't really have even that sense of rigor about what they're doing themselves. So I've laid a lot on the table there. Pull all that apart for us.
When I said if you're studying telepathy in the lab, you're doing magic, I think you are. I just because you haven't worked out how to think about it. If you are non-verbally communicating with someone in another room in a way that is accurate, that's what we would call magic in the kind of Northwest European cultures, right? But the trouble, and this comes back to the limitation of the wordings and the fact that they're 19th century, it is not, we've both had Dr. Kreipel on, if you look at cultures that haven't ever stepped away from this, it's not supernatural. It's not para, like it's not beside psychology and it's not above the natural. And that's where I think the steps into anthropology need to come from, because we need to look at the words we've been using, which have kind of tied our shoelaces together, especially as we've reached the end of the model, and see what the, you know, the guys next to us are wearing on their feet and give that a shot. As for, like, I agree, it's not that magic has the, and Dr. Skinner is an interesting example. It's not that magic has the definitive epistemology. So it's not like magic is a better way epistemologically of, you know, creating an understanding of how we see the world. So it's not that it has a provably better epistemology. I don't know what it looks like when you sort of blend them together. And Skinner's a good example of that. And he kind of admits that, he says, yes, I know this is actually quite a medieval belief that it is actual physical external spirits that respond to the sort of precision in a ritual magic context. But nevertheless, that's been my experience. So he kind of doubles down on it. In that case, I don't think that's magic in a wider ontological sense. He's specifically referring to Solomonic grimoiric magic. And he may be correct in that. Like, that actually may be, in the same way you're not really doing a Ouija without a board, for interacting with those sort of spirits, it may need those protocols. But that doesn't mean the same thing as at play when you're using tarot cards or sigil magic or so on. So that's where the challenges are. We're at the very beginning of having that kind of interdisciplinary discussion. And these are sort of natural road bumps in those first few years.
So now we need to drill into that, because now we're hitting it in a way that I haven't heard anyone talk about it. So we go back to Dr. Stephen Skinner, and he's saying a couple of things that are shocking to a lot of people, but I certainly admire the way that he just kind of lays it out on the table. And you should really, well, I'm going to say it as I understand it, and you can correct me, because this is, you have a much deeper and better understanding of it. But he says, number one, I'm not appealing to God or some divine entity. I'm appealing to kind of this middle layer of spirits that can affect this material world. So that's one thing that I think is extremely interesting. You know, when I talk about ontology, I mean, that's pretty controversial. I'll just leave it at that. And then number two, he's saying, and I can command them to do my bidding. I can make them, if I perform these certain rituals and acts in a certain way, they are required to act on my behalf in the material world. Now that would, one, that's incredibly controversial. And as you say, then there's a lot to pull apart. Well, how does that compare with someone else's magic? How does that compare with tarot or astrology or spell casting or, you know, whatever, you would know that world better than I do. So you have all that. And then number two, you have, okay, but in the process of proving that, you've now co-conspirators in research project, right? Because you're saying there's these forces, and he's personifying them. You know, he's saying there's these entities out there that are going to come in and work on this experiment with me. I just don't know if Dean's ready for all that. It doesn't sound like he's ready for that.
No, but he's not. And that is, when you're talking about Dr. Stephen Skinner and, you know, the Solomonic grimoires, you are at the extreme's the wrong word, but you're at the Olympic level of magic as expressed in Northwest European cultures. Because if we're talking about the interview with Greg on Higher Side Chats, for instance, I hear him say that, and like you, I want to jump in and do the interdisciplinary thing. Because if he's saying there are these intermediate, these are separate sometimes physical, sometimes non-physical beings that can interact and affect the physical world. I want to jump in and go, right, so I want to sit you down with some ufologists that I don't dislike, and I want to go through where some of that will match, because there is, it is parsimonious to suggest that we are talking about at least the same, in the broadest possible sense, world. So you kind of want to pull that out, and Dr. Skinner would not be in the least bit interested. I have enough trouble getting magicians to talk about that stuff as it is. And you kind of move down the set of protocols or contentions he's making, and you realize that if there is a kind of spirit world that will respond to us in a reliable or semi-reliable way, then you want to back that into anthropology. And then you want to go to, you know, the Amazon and start, or Indonesia, and start talking to shamans who make the exact same claims and see where that overlap is. So this is kind of what I mean by it being interdisciplinary. I don't think we need to go, okay, it turns out magic's probably a better, wider description than parapsychology and its associated terms. That doesn't mean we turn around and say, you, magician, explain what's going on, because that will be a disaster.
Right. Interesting. What else did you take away from your interview with Dean that you thought points to where this might eventually lead in the, you know, short to medium term?
I think it was further evidence from talking to biologists and anthropologists in the same thing, that the data we have that we follow in Skeptico has outrun, and it's outrun for a long time, the typical models that we use to describe them. And it is now untenable. So, for instance, when Starships came out, I got three separate anthropologists on three different continents emailing me going, I really like this book. We talk about this stuff quietly. We do not talk about it publicly in a professional venue. So I actually think the water is just too hot for the frogs in a bunch of disciplines now. And we're seeing, and Dean's kind of personifying or exemplifying that in parapsychology, but in other disciplines you're getting changes to the moronic 19th century version of evolution that we still learn about in school that hasn't been correct for decades, and it involves things like agency of plants and methods of communication, and all this stuff is coming up. And so that's kind of, it's very difficult at this exact point, as the edges are sort of fizzing away, to work out what the medium term looks like. In a funny sense, the long term is more predictable for us, listeners to the show, for instance. But in the medium term, it's anybody's guess, I think.
You know, that's a great point. And I really now, for the first time in this conversation, fully appreciate what you're saying about the anthropological connection and how that could kind of break that logjam in a way where they can point over there and go, yeah, but look at that guy over there, you know, and he's brought that into the lab. And I have people that are kind of saying the same thing. I mean, right? It kind of gives them that ability to cross-pollinate more freely, huh?
It does. And it also, it pulls the tide out of Western academia, and you see who's swimming racistly, because you don't have no credible anthropologist comes back from field work without him or her having a story of like, oh, and then they did this festival for the dead, and my guide's grandmother just walked, she's been dead 20 years, she walked up to the fire and sat down and they started talking. Now, they will tell you that over a drink. And so you have to turn around and go, okay, if we're all saying this, why is the presumption that, oh, the people need to examine the underlying assumption of the kind of softly, parapsychological, look, we've had it's a 52% rather than 50% chance thing. The power structure, the implicit power structure in that is saying that we've discussed before, that this tiny fraction of the population in this tiny sliver of history is correct and everyone else is deluding themselves. And even if they try to find the words to say, well, no, that's just maybe your truth or something, they still take the teeth out of the worldview. And it looks like it's going to be, you know, more, it looks like there's so much more to learn once we learn how to learn those things, if that makes sense. And that's where I think anthropology comes in. They're the least disappointing kind of field in better than parapsychology, the least disappointing field in incorporating things like the reality of whatever you want to call it, the spirit world or magical powers or any of these kind of loaded terms, they're doing it, I don't want to say well, but they're doing it not as badly as every other corner of the academy. So I think it's there we look first and have that sort of slowly unpack those foundational Western premises that we kind of attack on this show, and rightly so, very often.
Yeah. That's a good point. I mean, it's almost like their training prevents them from just stepping over the data like everyone else does and ignoring it. They're like, no, we don't do that. We've been taught over, you know, we've learned our lesson. We don't do that. Hey, let's move on and talk about your very interesting chat with George Hansen. Of course, most well known for the trickster phenomenon. Tell us about that.
Well, George's book is a classic in the field, and it's one of those cross-disciplinary ones that's been very popular in magic over the last 10 years as well, because when you're talking about a trickster phenomena, you're talking about a folk magic conception of the devil, you're talking about, you know, New Jersey's Mothman, you're talking about all these different phenomena that are very often associated with the practice or exploration of magic. So I've used some of his research in a number of my books because it, I think, as written in the book, it sheds some light, some directional light on how we at least conceptualize the unreliability and caprice of these phenomena. And that extends to UFOs as well. I mean, he nailed it by, you know, using an archetype of the trickster to describe it, because if anyone has had any experience with poltergeists, with UFOs, with what have you, there is a caprice bordering on malice, but it's not even malice. It's just a different sense of humor that is often associated with these phenomena. So it was a pleasure to talk to someone whose book I have read cover to cover a number of times.
So I thought he nailed it too, an interview on Rune Soup. And I'm like, where is this guy coming from? I mean, what you have written about his work, what so many other people have written about his book, what we have interpreted as the meaning of the trickster and how you just described it is so much more interesting than I what I took away as his interpretation of what the phenomenon is. I mean, he starts right out by he doesn't accept the personification of the trickster. He wants to keep it very, very sciencey, parapsychology. He comes across as this very, you know, super sci. I can't really say it, and you can say that. It's just, I don't know where you derive that kind of read of the data, that there isn't some agency, there isn't some entity. He completely seems to be closed to that idea.
I think he's more recently closed, is my understanding or recollection of the conversation, because he's only recently discovered things like post-structuralism that I don't think have a lot of value at all. Or at least a limited value in a limited domain, and not this one. So I actually think, and it's one of the, I guess it's the curse of being known for something, right? You end up having to, if you don't overdetermine it yourself, the fact that everyone knows you for it means you kind of have to dig down in it. And I don't think, because he didn't think the existentialists or the phenomenologists had something to say about the trickster phenomena, which I think is completely the opposite of correct, like absolute 180 wrong direction. And he's going in the kind of post-structuralist, it's all text direction. And I think it's a fad, because I think you'll get to the end of it like everyone else does. We all go through our post-structuralist phase and realize that this doesn't actually say anything. This is just like cutting up bits of the newspaper and putting it in a wind tunnel. This is not very useful. And that, I think, is probably what's happened with the trickster phenomena. It was slightly overdetermined to begin with, because one of the things that I didn't, where I realized maybe this thesis was overdetermined, was when he said magic is universally associated with the edge of society. Now, that's historically incorrect. Like, again, that's another 180, not at all true. And it's associated with the upper levels of power, and has been since Pharaoh. And so whilst the trickster phenomena specifically probably is a marginal phenomenon, that suggests that it can't explain all of magic, but the trickster phenomenon is a subset within this kind of magic as a wider idea. And that's when I'm like, oh, you've overdetermined this, because my example was Prince Philip, but I could have used Pharaoh. I could have used the Medici's. I could have used anyone. I could have used the CIA as people in power being interested in magic. And so, again, it's what happens when you write something really original. There's a risk that it gets overdetermined.
Maybe you're right. I think you're being incredibly generous, because if we take two of those cases that you, or two of those things that you just mentioned came up in the interview, one is Prince Philip, and I was like stunned. He's talking about the cultural elite, and he's saying we need to read parapsychology, and you know, our PhDs are the cultural elite, and Prince Philip isn't the cultural elite. That's an exact quote from the interview. And I'm like, what planet are you living on where you think these, you know, PhDs are the cultural elite? You know, I just published an interview with Dr. Henry Bauer on the science and how science has become, how it's just become so corrupted and untrustworthy. And, you know, here is a guy still trying to prop up that our cultural elite are our cobwebbed PhDs in academia.
Yes, I don't think anyone, I got the impression no one had actually called him on that before. And again, that's the overdetermined part of the thesis. The trickster phenomenon is a real thing. However, I just use the word trickster phenomenon and real in the one sentence. So let's just leave that aside. But whatever it is, it's a real thing. I just don't think it explains everything. And I don't think anyone's ever said to him, Prince Philip has had a lifelong interest in seances, crop circles, UFOs, and his wife's face is on the money. So come on.
Well, you know, and the other thing that I think in a way links the interview with Hansen and Dean Radin in a way that was hard for me to look past is this, they're completely oblivious to the conspiratorial part of things. And you, like you mentioned the CIA in the interview with Hansen, I love this when he goes, let me get the exact quote. You're talking about parapsychology and how there has been this long established connection between the intelligence community and parapsychology, but you kind of teed it up as a possible connection. And he said, no, you don't have to posit a connection with the intelligence community. And it's like, yeah, you don't, because I mean, it's like so proven. It's like, yeah.
I wanted to see if, like, you know how it is when you just have an hour, and I'm like, do I go in this direction? And that was an emphatic no, but it was a weird emphatic no in the sense that he probably realizes it is, and as in personally and professionally realizes it is, because I wanted to go into directions like, look, false memory syndrome, James Randi, all this stuff, it just back ends into the military. What are you talking about?
Exactly. And I'll tell you the connection I saw with the Dean Radin interview, who is much more plugged in and tuned in and a more open-minded guy, at least from the way I know him. But, you know, they get to talking. This is in his interview with Rick Archer on BatGap. And they're talking about Steven Spielberg. And they say, wow, you know, that guy, he's so great. He can really tap into the collective consciousness. Like, yeah. Like they did, yeah. You know, Close Encounters of the Third Kind and E.T. And I'm like, guys, I mean, this has been outed, the intelligence / CIA intelligence community's connection in shaping culture, and in most more specifically in really writing these movies and deciding which movies get the content has been, you know, so outed that to kind of muse about how, you know, that might have occurred is just stunning in a way. And it makes you, in the same way, it makes you wonder, are they completely ignoring that what is now well-established and necessary part of the equation that, you know, this extended consciousness realm and how our government has been playing there for as long as they could?
They are. And it's getting, I mean, you know, present company accepted. Everyone has incomplete worldviews, not us. Obviously, we're amazing. but you just, and this is kind of where I think in the medium term, it's just going to be messy because there are some people, we just mentioned Dr. Kuiper, for instance, who are amazing and intelligent and constitutionally unable to see this stuff without, I presume, like, you know, their world's melting. And that just is how it is. I don't think there's sort of like no clean water in the desert at this point in time. But it's getting so that when people say something like that, and it's one of the reasons, it's no shade, but like one of the reasons why BatGap isn't my jam is that kind of stuff where you'll just breeze past something that's just flat out denialism. And it colors for me, it makes me relativize the other statements or research because it's gotten so, here we are, two-thirds of the way through 2017. If you're unaware of this giant component of a field in which you allegedly work, then I have to have some questions about your potentially even competence in actually really understanding the discourse because it's it is, as we know, a necessary component. But I don't think we can do anything about it. I just think we can kind of go, guys, I can tell you with every confidence that there is something to it. I don't know what it is. And I don't think the next best step forward is to pretend it's not there.
Yeah, the only problem with that is you'd have to spread a little bit of that over Dean's way as well, because Dean's falling for that as well, and also falling for the, you know, his progressive politics, which are fine, but I mean they're completely oblivious to any kind of meta control or counterbalancing force called globalism or anything like that is just completely, you know, off the table. It's kind of,
yeah, and I think so. I think that's definitely a fair statement to make, no question. And I do think it has it falls to other people, potentially more interdisciplinary loudmouths like us, to kind of stitch those things together. I don't know where it goes. I know it's a factor that needs to be folded in to how we think about this stuff. And if they won't fold it in, then we will, and we'll hand it off to someone else and we'll get through this kind of patchy medium term. But I agree completely. And I think the next few steps, well, the next few years we'll see people at least hand wave, because Dr. Kuiper kind of hand waves at the beginning of the books going like, oh, and there is a, you know, long-term involvement between the deep state and whatever the UFO phenomenon is. Now on to Whitley Strieber.
Right. right.
And I think you're going to see more, like, I mean, you rightly call him for that, but I think you're going to see more of that kind of stuff. And it's kind of like when anthropologists start using the M word, or when Dean gets up on stage and uses the M word, I think the way through this is to make it okay to admit that that stuff is there rather than pretend it's not, rather than kind of everyone, let's get together and, you know, have a definitive statement on this. Let's just let it, let the ice crack and so on.
Great. Okay, so there's a lot of interesting stuff there that you've brought out in terms of the future of parapsychology. I feel tempted to just kind of leave that there for a minute because I wanted to spend a few minutes talking about UFO research and might as well tee it up the same way. You know, the future of UFO research. We've emailed back and forth about this series of interviews, I think pretty remarkable interviews that Jacques Vallée has given. One he gave on Skeptico, but he did one on Paracast and he did one on Grammarica, are the three that I've listened to. There have probably been other ones out there. And some really, really interesting stuff came out in those interviews, particularly, I think, of interest to like you and I because of our interest in consciousness and the connection between consciousness and the UFO thing that it's been my contention for the last couple of years. And like my interview with Robbie Graham and Robert that got a little bit heated in a way, and like that the UFO people have misunderstood really the whole consciousness thing. I mean, it's like any, you know, new toy. They've kind of taken it out and they've ran it around so much that they kind of, the wheels fall off and they don't even recognize that. So what's
100%.
tell us, what do you make of what's going on there and with this latest round of interviews from Jacques Vallée?
I've only heard the one with you, of course, but I read the journals when he self-published them on Lulu the day they came out, and I found them as flooring then as you did. Like, even in the introduction, I just love that kind of stuff. He's old now. He's done all this amazing thing, so he'll just open it up with the introduction. And by the way, this is going on. But I've been a huge Vallée fan all along. I think... And, you know, it's kind of like what we were talking about. The risk with parapsychology, if they start using the M word, is that it will do what UFO or ufology has done over the last 5 years, which is just spin its wheels. What happens when you say, oh, it's a consciousness effect, is that you are freed from examining actual data or doing any kind of meta-analysis, because anything can be anything. And it fell out of, funnily enough, Dr. Strassman's DMT research is how I understand what happened to ufology. There was about 10 years ago when Dr. Strassman's spirit molecule stuff ended up in other alternative researchers' material. After that, we just got this kind of full magic, in a derogatory sense, a version of ufology that I think is hopefully winding back, because absolutely it looks for most of the time like what Dr. Skinner thinks spirits are. But sometimes it isn't. Sometimes there are ruins on Mars. And you can't let that go, because it's just cleaner to say, it's all a consciousness, which is fine, except there are ruins on Mars.
Completely agree with you. And so let me kind of go over the highlights of what I heard Vallée saying in this series of interviews, and then maybe we can chat about him a little bit, because he comes out and says, to your point exactly, that one, he's very much into material science, right? So he's helping researchers get, you know, aerial photos that might reveal more landing or trace elements. He's helping with mass spectrometers and all this kind of stuff that, again, you know, people, I think it's going to be interesting to see the fallout from these series of interviews, because it's really going to, should, if people are honest, should knock a lot of these UFO researchers on their heels and say, hey, wait a minute, what have I been spinning about this consciousness stuff? Here's a guy who's looking at photos, who's looking at, you know, trace elements left behind, you know, and then he's also very open to the UFO, the ufology narrative, the kind of ancient aliens kind of thing. He's talking, you know, Cicero, and he's talking, oh, yeah, that's relevant. He's open to Roswell. You know, again, people are like, ha, 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 Roswell. And he goes, well, you know, Roswell, the waters have been muddied, but we must assume it's true because there's other cases of crash landing reports. Boom, check that one off the list. And then he comes to the actual sightings. And this, to me, typifies the whole series of interviews. And I think it was on Gramerica. But he goes, you know, they're kind of hammering him, going, well, what's new in 40 years? They're kind of being devil's advocate, you know, because this is a good interview. But they go, you know, what's new? And they're going, yeah, I get it. You know, that's a fair question. What's new? And he goes, well, look at MUFON. He goes, 40 years, they're still doing the same thing. And everyone chuckles, ha, 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 everyone laughs. And then he pauses, he goes, and that's exactly what they should be doing. They should be gathering these reports in the same way. They should be collecting the data in the same way. And it was like just exactly, I guess, what I'm talking about in terms of, I think in some fundamental ways, he's been misunderstood because people have taken some very important and revolutionary ideas that he'd had, and they've kind of run with them a little bit past where he's run with them.
Yeah, and that's been happening to him for decades. So you get that if you read his Forbidden Science books as well. But when he's initially positing, because he's sort of a Rosicrucian and a spiritual man, as well as being, you know, an angel investor and a astrophysicist and a UFO researcher. So he's, you know, very much a Renaissance type person. But even in the like 60s and 70s, when he said there's a consciousness component to this, people said, oh, so you think they're making it up, or they imagine it, or it's a hallucination. He's like, no, the phenomena are real. They show up on radar. They land. They cause radiation effects. I'm saying there's a consciousness component to it. And I think people miss some of his favorite ones are this sort of giant craft that were chased over Belgium. And you go, that I didn't fucking imagine. That didn't come out of my head. And that, I think, is where people have maybe either not deliberately misinterpreted him, but kind of breezed over it because they wanted to write a book about fairies or Bigfoot or something and kind of bundle it all together. And it's my kind of problem with any of these sort of monist interpretations. If you make it everything, you make it nothing.
Right. Good point. Well, Gordon, what else is going on with you and Rune Soup? You have so much going on, but you really ought to tell people about what's been happening. You have a bunch of other very interesting interviews that have gone up, but you're also working on some products and some projects. So fill us in.
Yeah, so the website has a premium member component, and it has a whole bunch of stuff. We do weekly video Q&As and different kind of group projects, remote viewing, group prayer stuff, that kind of thing. And each quarter, there's also a course that is either on something like Sigil Magic or Grimoire Magic and so on. And that's, it's going really well. People are responding to it. That's in the premium component. The website and the podcast are all always completely free, and it's great. As you know, it's a lot of work, but it's just really fun.
Fantastic. Do you have any kind of word on what's been going on with some of the experiments you've been running? I mean, somewhat ad hoc, but I like the way you've tried to put some reasonable controls on there, and I think there's so much opportunity for making progress in that way. I mean, some of these experiments with some just reasonable common sense controls can yield some pretty interesting results, but I don't know where you're at with some of those.
Well, that's kind of the priorities for Q4. We're going to be looking at them with some more rigor. So it's been, because it's not a teaching modality, right? It's a collection of people who are serious about seriously interested in this kind of stuff. So I don't actually know what's going to happen. And we kind of share it going, let's try this. And people have had some really, really profound, it's anecdotal stuff, but you know, we both have no problem with a word if it's used correctly. There's been some really, really profound responses and changes in people's lives and circumstances and so on. And in Q4, I hope that we can put sort of some more rigor around it now that there are, now that people's kind of feet are under the desk, so to speak.
Well, great. I certainly encourage folks to check out all the great interviews we've been doing on Rune Soup lately are terrific. And the other stuff, I am a premium member and like hearing about all that stuff and seeing what's going on. So certainly wish you the best of luck with all of that. Thanks for coming back on and talking about the future of parapsychology. Who the hell else is going to plot the future of parapsychology than this magician down there in Tasmania, soon to be in Tasmania?
Yeah, well, if it's not me, it's you, definitely. So I look to you, Alex.
Okay, now we're really in trouble. Thanks again to Gordon White for joining me today on Skeptico. One question I guess I'd tee up from this interview, and it's the big one, the one I asked at the beginning. Is parapsychology going through this foundational change that we alluded to in this show? Dean Radin's talk about magic and spirit and broadening his investigation of psi in that way. Is that a major sea change, or are we making too much out of a guy who just wrote another book, and this time he focused on magic? I think you might have an idea where I tend to lean on that, but of course the purpose of throwing this question out there is to get your opinion, and I'd very much like to hear your opinion. The place to give it is at skeptico.com, skeptiko.com, where you can listen to all the previous shows, 360 or whatever of them, all for free, no paywall, no advertising, just there for you to enjoy. And hopefully share with other people. I know a lot of you do that. We've had a lot of new listeners coming on board lately. The show's been around for a long time, but Things change. People come and go. So if you're a longtime listener and you haven't recommended the show to someone in a long time, consider doing so. Post about it. Write about it. Do whatever you have to. I love to bring new people into this Skeptico community and this thought group that we have going on. One other thing of kind of Skeptico business, if you're out there and if you're a listener to this show and you want to help the show or look for more opportunities to be involved with the show, please let me know. I am potentially looking for that kind of help. I'm not sure what that means. We'll just throw it out there to the universe and see what turns up and kind of take it from there. But if you feel so inclined, that means you're the right person. And please do send me an email. It's easy to find my email or find me on Facebook. You'll find me. Anyways, I have a number of interesting shows coming up. Fast and Furious, they're coming out a little bit faster than I have the ability to churn them out and maintain kind of a normal phony baloney life like I like to do. So we'll see how I balance all of that. But until then, do take care. Bye for now.